This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Look, I'm going to do my best to end up in a kind of hopeful and optimistic place. But I am by nature, my sort of profession is a kind of I'm sort of a professional bummer-outer of people, you know? So we're going to have to deal with that for a little while, because there's no use not. We need to figure out just where we are in order to figure out where we need to go.
Yes, it's ugly being green these days. That was Bill McKibben opening a speech in Colorado, touring with his new book, Earth, the post-Copenhagen capitulation to a new and damaged planet. Download the whole speech as an MP3 from our Climate 2010 page. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, where reality becomes the new horror genre. Not the oil blowing into the Gulf of Mexico, not the BP dispersants, the largest chemical experiment on the ocean ever, not even the phony permits, non-existent backup plans, the cover-up. The real unreported tragedy. Nobody gets this story. Humans now know they are shifting the climate toward a greenhouse world. We just had the hottest January to April global temperatures ever recorded. Over 200 scientists just put out a warning that the press didn't bother to print. And yet the green champions in the Senate still brought out a bill calling for more offshore drilling. The Canadian government still approves even deeper wells on the East Coast. Drilling now, as you hear this, in the Chevron company, with even less hope of recovery from an accident. And they want to do it in the Arctic and on the West Coast. The shame, we say, is that we didn't get a chance to burn all that oil, to send the carbon into the atmosphere, where some will fall back into the ocean anyway, into the Gulf of Mexico, and all oceans, turning them acidic, killing off life at the basis of the food chain. Nobody wants to say, if we cared for our children and grandchildren at all, if we cared about the world, we would stop all oil exploration anywhere today. Call it off. The atmosphere can't take another drop hauled out from under the sea, from under the land, from the tar. We will all drive away from this accident as though the greenhouse world isn't coming, arriving slow and almost unstoppable, visible and denied. Do you think I'm being too bleak? Just another climate alarmist? Professor George Martin Kennedy from the University of California, Riverside, made a speech April 8, 2010. It's called, What Awaits Us in the Greenhouse World? Watch the whole hour-long video with the link in my May 20th EcoShock blog. Snatching out a clip or two, listen how rapid climate change can be.
Now, what we're seeing here is that this stable period, we call the Holocene, is where human history has evolved. But the preceding 110,000 years is characterized by very rapid temperature changes. And these are significant changes. These aren't just small. But again, this is the difference between having a glacier on your doorstep and the difference of having a very hot Maryland summer. You know, it's really quite different. This shift from full glacial conditions, absolute ice age, to the warm Holocene occurred over 3 cycles, 3 years. This is less than 10 years in change. So we know the Earth's system can change like that. Now, what happened to initiate this change? It wasn't one of those nice linear ball rolls up, ball rolls down. What happened here was there was a massive meltwater release in the North Atlantic, and it utterly changed the circulation pattern of the North Atlantic Ocean. It shut down the Gulf Stream, and it entirely froze much of Europe in this period of very cold climate. Now, why that matters is it tells us that the Earth's system actually functions rapidly, and it can function with triggers or past thresholds.
The forces that created a hothouse world for the dinosaurs are nothing compared to our industrial emissions.
The next question you might ask is, well, that was geologic time. 10,000 years ago is a long time, or 12,000 years ago even. Statistically, I'm pretty sound here. I don't have to worry about this. But the one thing that people that study systems, and particularly tipping points and thresholds, will tell you is in a strongly forced system, a tipping point is most likely. And by a common sense argument, we are in a period of Earth's history with the strongest strongest pressure on the climate system that the Earth has ever seen. Now, that argument is really straightforward. There has never been a time in Earth's history when a systematic mechanism has mined reduced carbon. What I mean there is hydrocarbons and coal, oxidized them and put them in the atmosphere. No other animal, no other process, there is no other mechanism that you can identify, that I'm aware of, that could do what we have done. We have taken Earth's thermostat and we have jammed a blowtorch against it, in a sense. Boy, that sounds dramatic. But the point is, we are really forcing that thermostat. And this is the mechanism with which we're doing it. It's very straightforward. Every barrel of hydrocarbon we produce, we are putting that CO2 in the atmosphere, and that is our temperature controller. And there is another time in Earth's history when this could have happened. So, you get great Hollywood movies out of this, but this is not what I'm worried about. I am not worried about a giant tsunami coming into New York. In fact, it would be kind of cool, but this is not going to happen. So this is not climate change. This is like a weather event. And frustratingly, the confusion of the press of weather with climate is really annoying, because weather is dramatic and it's extreme, and hurricanes are incredibly destructive, newsworthy things. But what we're talking about here is insidious, subtle, scary, nasty averages that change fundamental components of the climate system in ways that we can't see it until it's too late.
Finally, Professor Kennedy's big worry, the clathrate catastrophe. The public barely learned about the frozen gobs of methane, called clathrates, lurking at the seabed as they clogged the ill-fated fix-it dome lowered by BP over the Gulf oil leak. Scientists suggest the seas are already warming, and some have found evidence of melting methane in the seas off Siberia.
So if you imagine there's twice as much methane, and it's 20 to 60 times more efficient, that's concerning. But it's more concerning when you consider it's unstable, it's ice. It melts with 2 degrees of temperature change. It's melted in the past and totally changed the climate and caused extinction events. And we are looking at temperature changes about on that order. The question is this a mechanism that is going to become one of those feedbacks or tipping points in our near future? Because if it is, our climate will abruptly change to a completely uninhabitable greenhouse world for us, and it will do it very, very quickly. And it does it by this. We warm some parts of the ocean. That methane is melted. It's released to the atmosphere. That methane acts to warm the atmosphere. More methane is melted. That methane then goes into the atmosphere and contributes to the warming and melts more methane further at higher latitudes. What we're describing is a positive feedback in which all of the methane zippers open and melts catastrophically across the planet. Now, has this happened in the past? Is it an entire hypothetical? Well, the work we do in my lab is to go back into ancient events and identify causes of the abrupt climate change. What we're doing here in South Australia is we're looking at one of these events in which the coldest period in Earth history transitioned to one of the warmest periods in Earth history over a very short amount of time. We're thinking thousands of years. This period of climate change, we have to go back almost 600 million years to see, but it looks almost identical in rates of change as our present condition. And the driver for this is almost certainly methane, clathrate melting. This is a case where we can confirm this mechanism had a catastrophic effect. This is the scariest piece of science I'll ever see in my life. This came out last summer. It came out from a research group in Britain, and it comes from a cruise off Svalbard, where the researchers on this cruise, on this vessel, recorded a series of enormous methane venting bursts across the seafloor. What this suggests is these high latitude areas are starting to see the first release of this methane. We've been seeing it in permafrost, but now if it really is the ocean reservoir that's beginning to warm and release methane, that is a very scary scenario for our future. There is no backing off of this. There is no remediation. There is nothing that governmentally we can do as a civilization if this is actually occurring. What we need to know is if this really is occurring, and if it really does pose an imminent threat.
That was Professor George Kennedy from his video, What Awaits Us in the Greenhouse World. Go ahead and Google that. It gets worse. Dr. James Hansen of NASA says there may be no limit to the heating brought about by our sudden release of gigatons of carbon dioxide into the shallow atmosphere. It is not impossible to blow off the normal skin around the Earth of air, taking us into the superheated state of Venus, or maybe eventually the killing cold of Mars. Or this one from our Radio EcoShock special on Greenhouse Worlds, broadcast January 4, 2008. Here is a clip from Dr. Michael Oppenheimer speaking to a meeting for financial movers and shakers.
What's going on now, definitely, is that the greenhouse gases are building up due to human activity, not due to these biological changes. And there's nothing to reverse that except us reversing emissions, nor do we know of any limit in the climate system that would stop the warming. There could be one. Maybe when we get to 4 to 5 degrees warming, there's something that happens that we don't know about. There's a lot we don't know. But, you know, we can't make policy based on a hope.
How darkly ironic. Now our best weak hope comes from the man who sees catastrophe coming, but a warming limited by nature itself, by the living reactions of Gaia. That would be Britain's James Lovelock. Is it possible? What could stop the roaring train of greenhouse warming we've released? In this program, you'll hear from a Gaian scientist and veteran journalist, Dr. Melanie Linnart. Her new book is Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. And if we have time, I'll also review another excellent source, a book from the Open University called The Cretaceous World. We have a lot to learn from the times of the dinosaurs when carbon levels soared along with the temperature. The mass of life, including forests, moved towards the ice-free poles. That may be the future, unless we undergo a revolution very soon, starting with a movement to leave the coal and oil in the ground where it cannot damage the sea, the sky, and all future generations. Meanwhile, let us see how the Earth balances itself in the coming greenhouse world. Most scientists now believe we are heading into a hotter world. Even 350.org campaigner Bill McKibben calls it Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, a new planet in the making. We humans plan responses, but we are not alone here. Mother Earth, or Gaia, is a mass of interlocking life forms and changing physical systems. And she has lived in ice-free worlds many times before. Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. That is the title of a new book by Melanie Linnart from the University of Arizona. We have her on the line now. Melanie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the first thing I noticed in your book, yes, you are a scientist with a PhD in natural resources and global change, but your work is stuffed with quotes from conferences, from discussions with other scientists, from letters and emails, and I thought to myself, this person has operated like a journalist as much as a scientist, and indeed, you are a science writer as well. So how did you arrive at this unusual marriage of research and journalism?
I actually started out as a journalist and spent about 10 years mostly in newspapers. I ended up getting a master's degree in forestry back in the early 90s, and that was when I first got interested in Gaia theory. I read about how the planet is a living system, and then right after that, I went to Puerto Rico to work on an internship at the Institute of Tropical Forestry at the time, and we were struck by a hurricane within about a week of my arrival there. It was a terrifying experience, and one of the reasons I feel so empathetic about people who are going through hurricanes. But one thing that really struck me is that the forest there, which actually took the brunt of the winds, recovered, at least appeared to recover within a few months. So that I was still on the island, and leaves had regrown where it had been like an apocalyptic vision. They were resprouting straight from the trunks. Now, it's very different than a clear cut because there was a lot of material still on the forest floor. So after that experience, then later I was working as a journalist, and I just kept coming back to that. Like, I want to know more about this, how the Earth does it, why it's so resilient, or, you know, how it could be resilient if we get out of the way. And so that drew me back to graduate school. So it was actually the idea of working on this book that brought me back to get my PhD. So that's why I was working as a scientist and going to a lot of conferences and was very lucky to be talking to some of the top climatologists of the time, and I was doing some writing for a publication there. So all that kind of came together, and it was very exciting when I finally got to merge those two sides of myself into this book and have the scientist side and the journalist side kind of merged together.
Well, the result of all that hard work had a lot of new facts and ideas for me. And I was sort of taken back to a radio conversation that I heard from Australia where Gaia inventor James Lovelock suggested the climate would not enter a runaway state into a boiling disaster like the planet Venus. He said natural systems would limit the warming as they had many times in the past. Is that partly why you wrote this book?
Yes, I think partly just for that, to help people understand what we're facing. I guess my hope is still that we won't end up the kind of, even though it doesn't turn into a runaway warming, as Lovelock inspired me to originally think about how the Earth can survive somehow. It doesn't go off and turn all our water into steam. The whole planet has not frozen over, at least since life has evolved in, insects and vascular plants. You know, it's still not really a good thing for society, so I think that part of my reasoning is just to let people know, one, that the planet is not really up for extinction, assuming that we were cleared out before it got that bad. I think the planet can survive much warmer climates than this. It's had greenhouse levels higher and temperatures much higher, but what you get during those time frames is almost a tropical condition throughout the globe. And that also means sea levels that are about 150 feet to 300 feet higher, which obviously would create many, many problems for us. I mean, even coast inland seas could cover large parts of continents. And that's part of the reason that wetlands expand during warmer climates, as do forests. So I think for the people who are worried that we're killing the planet, it's helpful for them to know the planet can survive this. But I guess I also wanted the rest of us who worry about our friends and family and you know, other species around to realize this is not a game. This is something that can happen. This has happened in the past, and the link between greenhouse gases and warm climate is pretty clear when you look at it at these long time scales.
Definitely. Well, for some listeners, I'd like to backtrack just a bit. And can you explain to us what Gaia is? How do you see it?
Well, I'll start out with how Lovelock originally envisioned it, which is kind of a system of interlocking life on the planet that has the capacity, therefore, to somewhat control climate temperature. And again, not in the terms of climate control where it's always 72 degrees, but more in the terms of, you know, we've got the poles, we've got the hot tropics, and we've had times when both of those were more dominant, but still life can exist. So that's kind of his philosophy, and that goes back to our planet. Instead of having 98% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere like Venus and Mars do of their atmospheric composition, we have less than 1%. We're working up to about 0.04%. And even that, you can see how much that makes a difference in warming our climate. Between that and the other greenhouse gases, the climate is warm enough to not be frozen over as it might otherwise be. So life has an important role, and of course, everybody knows that plants are producing oxygen. Our planet is 21% oxygen, which is what makes us as animals able to be mobile and get around, because we need that kind of energy. So that's kind of where it started from. And then he did add some refinements later to include the physical system, and that's where working with climate really got me interested in that side. And I began to think of hurricanes and some of these extreme storms, really any type of precipitation, as the sweat of the earth. So just as we sweat, when we sweat, our drop of water that evaporates from our skin surface takes with it some heat, and that's why we sweat, to cool off. It's a way we cool off. Well, in a similar way, the planet, when it's evaporating water, lifts heat up, and kind of the circulation system, as we call it in climate, that move storms out around the world, basically from the hottest part of the world to cooler parts, and that's why hurricanes exist. They basically come up and in the heat of summer, just as the hottest days are kind of have been warming the surface, and you know, they move the heat out from the tropics into the subtropics and further.
When it comes to hurricanes, one of the principal researchers has been Carrie Emanuel from MIT in New England. And I recall at first Dr. Emanuel said there would be more Atlantic hurricanes, and then he revised that to just more of the most powerful storms. Is that correct?
I don't remember him saying more hurricanes. I remember it was more intense hurricanes, and I think sometimes that might have been subject to different interpretations. As far as I recall, his premise has been that warming seas, he's done some really wonderful physics. I quote him quite a bit in my book. I have a lot of respect from him. But, you know, he just shows how sea surface temperatures really rev up hurricanes. And the paper that got so much attention was initially in 2005, which was published like a couple months before Katrina hit, just basically showed if you added up all the potential energy that hurricanes in the Atlantic are moving around, then you would see that the energy level increased. You know, they kind of were mirror images, the hurricane potential energy, destructive energy, we would call it, and the sea surface temperatures. So he looked at it like for each season, and, you know, it was alarmingly matched.
We know that a lot of the extra energy that's coming into the planet that's being mirrored back by this carbon dioxide cover and other greenhouse gas emissions, that a lot of that's going into the sea. So can we presume that that is the reason why we would get more powerful storms?
Yes, that would be when you've got extra heat coming in. Like you say, we're about 70% water on this planet. So a lot of that warming is going into the ocean, and it takes longer. You know, our land can heat up really quickly, but anybody who's been swimming on a hot day, the water is not always warm. It depends on where you're at. There's currents and things, but it takes longer for the ocean for water to warm up. So that has been where a lot of our heat has been going, and that's part of the reason why scientists are pretty confident that we've got some more warming ahead of us. Even if we stopped emitting all our greenhouse gases now, stopped driving and running electricity, we would still have some warming ahead of us for a little while because of that extra heat and the greenhouse gases that are already there.
On the other hand, James Lovelock and many other scientists say that eventually, perhaps in a million or many millions of years, without ice caps, the planet heat distribution systems like winds and ocean currents should stagnate, entering a relatively stable state. So I would presume from that that the period of great storms may be a limited time of transition, even if it seems endless to our human time scale.
Actually, I don't see any evidence that hurricanes would stop. Now, when there's a difference between talking about regular winds, and so what they're talking about is now with the poles being warmer and the tropics being also warm, you wouldn't have as much of that gradient. A lot of times you get your winds from the cool moving to the warm or vice versa. Just things are moving around to fill a vacuum. Usually it's the cool moving to the warm. But in some of these times of the past, the poles were really toasty. Not only was the ice gone, there were forests there. Crocodiles were swimming up near Ellesmere Island in Canada. This is about 50 million years ago during the Eocene. So it was a completely different condition, and it even seems like some of that tropical rainfall was getting all the way up to the poles. So what that's saying is that the tropics are managing to get its precipitation pretty far north in this case. So there's actually reason to believe that hurricanes would kind of fill the bill and pick up. The tropics is still going to be warming faster than the poles in any climate just because the tropics are where the sunlight comes in most intensely. That's just the way our planet is configured. So somehow that extra heating in the tropics has to move out, and, you know, ocean currents could help and precipitation in general, but I think hurricanes would be one of the big things. And in fact, some Japanese researchers, led by last name Ito, I-T-O, found that if you look at evidence of past storms, there's a tremendous peak at about 100 million years ago during the Cretaceous when temperature was at one of its highest points in the record.
And we've just had the excitement of air cancellations from the Icelandic volcano, and I notice in your book you tell us that volcano eruptions might also dampen hurricane production. How does that work?
You know, it could very well relate to their cooling in general, because basically, now this volcano, I should point out, doesn't seem to have gotten its ash high enough where it's turning into a global phenomenon. So at this point, it's mostly regional. It's Europe. It's at the height where planes are flying, and that's what's so much trouble with it. But it's when you get above that area, above the clouds and above the weather, really, that's when that ash can really make a difference for a year or so. It's basically almost like a shade over the planet. It's just a black ash blocking some of the sunlight. And so you're not heating up the ocean surface as much. That's a big one. And it tends to reduce precipitation in general because, well, for one thing, precipitation tends to increase as temperature goes up. So if you're cooling things down and not enough sunshine's getting through or as much, that's definitely going to affect evaporation rates, which is how you get your fodder for precipitation. So I don't think this volcano is going to cool things down from what it's done yet, but, you know, I don't know that it's done acting up.
Well, I guess it depends on whether it stimulates the volcano next door, but that's a whole another story. But I did want to ask you, is there evidence that storms were stronger millions of years ago when we did have hothouse worlds?
I think that the evidence that I've seen so far has been mainly that one I was just mentioning where they're basically looking at the wavelengths between storms from sediment deposits of these ancient storms. So there was a real peak 100 million years ago, and in fact, all around that time frame, the storms were a lot higher than what we've seen. Even within thousands of years ago, there's been other researchers doing work on sediments that are showing that we're kind of in a relatively low period. Although I should also mention that during the ice ages, it looks like there weren't, and this is actually more based on computer modeling rather than sediments, but it looks like there probably wouldn't be nearly as many hurricanes because of the cooler temperatures and things. But as far as precipitation, so that's hurricanes, it's a little more conjecture based on modeling, but we know that the ice age planet had lower precipitation overall. So it was about half, roughly, of what we have now. And in fact, in those hothouse worlds, you would expect to get kind of a doubling because the temperature was about 20 degrees or more warmer on average. I'm speaking Fahrenheit here. And so with that kind of increase, you'd expect a doubling of the air can hold twice as much moisture when it's that much warmer.
And that, listeners, is the kind of fantastic information that you get from this book. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with scientist Melanie Lenart, author of Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. If you have just joined us, we are trying to peer into the future hotter world using new research into past climates and current developments. Our guest, Melanie Lenart, offers us some hope that Earth comes with an operating system that eventually balances itself. And I'd like to quote Melanie just a little bit from your book. You say, roughly three-quarters of the last half a billion years of Earth's history involved times when carbon dioxide levels and temperatures were higher than modern levels. And ending the quote, that is when most modern plant life appeared. Are you saying the plants are already prepared by evolution for a hothouse world?
I guess it kind of does amount to that. The plants have been through that, and they actually have an internal system where you actually see somewhat of an increase in the temperature that they consider optimum, their best temperature for photosynthesis, for producing carbohydrates. It actually goes up slightly as carbon dioxide levels go up. So that's our greenhouse gas that, of course, we're extremely worried about it because of all the changes it can cause in temperature, but it's also a major element, one of the main ingredients of plants. That's not to say that every plant that we have living where it is now is going to be fine. Plants are going to need to move, and we've already seen them moving. There's some good documentation about plants moving up mountains because it cools as you go up a mountain, and moving north as climate warms up. So that's been documented pretty well, and that's one of the good examples that goes beyond temperature measurements of, oh, yeah, we know it's warming. The problem I see, and this is part of the reason that, you know, I want to alert people to this, is the plants can adapt, but then what do they do now where we've got cities along the coast and wetlands that would be expanding? Instead, you see a place like a situation like in Louisiana where they're actually losing ground because we've got our cities along the fringes, and we're taking all the sediment that would normally be building land in the Mississippi and Louisiana. We're taking all that sediment out along the way as we drain the river. We've got that here in the west. The Colorado River does not even make it to its delta anymore. It's dried out by us before it even gets there. So even though the planet under its normal circumstances would be able to handle this warming, I have to wonder about how it's going to do when we're actually using so much of the water, so much of the land for between cities and farms. Is there room for the planet to do what it needs to do?
As I was reading away about hurricanes in your book, I came to kind of a point of disagreement, or maybe just a question about underlying Gaia theory. You suggested in your writing that hurricanes have a purpose, and that suggests to me some sort of intent or organizing principle that applies even to non-living systems on the planet. Is that part of your understanding of Gaia?
Well, you know, I like to think of it, Gaia, as kind of going back to Lewis Thomas's imagery of the Earth as a cell. And, you know, a cell doesn't have a brain, but it has a membrane that somehow can filter things out. And I don't understand how it knows how to do that. But, you know, I think when you get down and look at it, it's usually a physics going on at some level where there's just different cell walls operating in this way and that. And the planet, he compared the atmosphere of the planet to a cell membrane, which is a lovely image that basically says the atmosphere is created to filter out the ultraviolet light that we get filtered out by ozone, and also to hold in some of the heat. I mean, I think, it doesn't require a design, an intentional design. It's just kind of like this is how it evolved, partly from physics. I mean, a lot of the hurricane stuff just does come down to physics, so it doesn't require that somebody's intentionally thinking about it. It's just the water responding to the heat and, you know, the circulation shifting around. But life has evolved within that context, within this context of the physics. So there's just some understanding of it. And then with that in mind, so we've got, say, the hurricanes just becoming stronger as climate warms, and monsoons, too, by the way, as it gets warmer. So then you've also got your plants expanding. You've got your forest expanding, coastal mangroves expanding. Some of that also is from the higher carbon dioxide levels. But now life can evolve in these different conditions and has evolved, in fact, to get us more wetlands and like cedar swamps and things that can actually be useful during times of intense hurricanes. I mean, you really want your wooded swamps, your wooded wetlands or swamps at the coast to help break those storms. They can collect storm surge and slow the winds, because the winds will be slowed by friction. So I think it's just partly just physics, but then life evolves in that context.
And you know, more recently, paleoclimatologist Peter Ward from Washington State has written The Medea Hypothesis, which directly criticizes Gaian theory. Ward suggests life is bumbling at best. He compares it to Mr. Bean, and may be even self-destructive given the past record of thoughtless competition between biota and mass extinctions. Have you read Ward's work, and would you still stick to the Gaian point of view in face of that?
I've read some of his work, and I've actually cited some of his work from Out of Thin Air in Life in the Hothouse. But, you know, I think that there's a lot of mysteries that remain. I certainly don't think we have any kind of regulatory system that's super precise. I mean, you know, even if you look at Gaia theory, there was a point when the trees and wetlands expanded so much that they took down so much carbon dioxide, this is the raining theory, that then the Earth went into an 80 million year long ice age. I mean, that's a bit bumbling in that way. But then decomposers evolved, and then this balance between decomposing the tree, the wood, and things that are going into the wetlands and having them being sequestered, that carbon staying in the soil and wetlands, that balance has evolved. So I think that these systems have been evolving over time and getting better at regulating certain things. I mean, forests are just amazing things, and some of the same concepts that even as Lovelock was developing Gaia theory, there were others like the Odom brothers, H.T. Odom and Eugene Odom, that were developing, putting these ideas on ecosystems. And, I mean, people have pretty much acknowledged at this stage that forests are recycling water to kind of create conditions to make it more conducive for their continued existence. The Amazon is a beautiful case in point where maybe 35% of the water, I think the estimates are, are being recycled from the trees themselves. And I've seen a beautiful illustration of that I describe in the book, too, which is that it has to do kind of with an inversion. If you think of the trees are tall and they're intercepting the sunlight, so it's hotter higher up in the canopy. I think they put it at about 60 feet than it is on the ground. You've got these hotter conditions that kind of put the lid on air movement. And you can tell when you're in a forest, there's just not much wind at all in the interior of a forest. Trees do a good job of blocking the wind. But in addition, they keep it, you know, kind of trap some of that water vapor. And so their argument, one of the authors of that is Mara Kieva, it's her last name. But they surmise that these trees are, you know, basically just the system of the forest. Again, this stuff comes back down to physics, but the trees are evolving in that situation. They're managing to trap some of the water so then it condenses again as it cools at night.
We all wonder how hot things could get. James Hansen, director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies, as I said, has wondered whether we might get to a Venus state. And I've heard Dr. Michael Oppenheimer said he isn't aware of any mechanism to limit Earth's final temperature. But this is what your book is all about, the reactions that might preserve a habitable planet for at least some life forms. What is the hottest period Earth reached in the past half billion years or so?
Well, that's still up for debate, but I know there was a real peak at the mid-Cretaceous, and I kind of focus on that as one of the areas. So that's about 100 million years ago. And some of the numbers, that was when the ice was completely melted, and there weren't a lot of mountains either, it seems, although it's hard to be sure about how high the land was, but... And there were a lot of underwater volcanoes just emitting greenhouse gases tremendously, so that really led to that warming at that point, from what we can tell. But it looks like the global temperature was about 80 or maybe even 85 degrees Fahrenheit as a whole, compared to what we have now, which is about 60 degrees. You know, the odd thing is, and so my hope that we, you know, that the planet won't go off on a crazy... steam-producing temperature rise would be kind of related to looking at these past climates when it was so much hotter, and yet somehow life did survive. Well, that was the time of the dinosaurs, and some of them were up around the poles, even though they're cold-blooded, so-called. And, you know, there were a lot of things going on. Life was actually quite abundant, and there was a lot of forests and what we would call biomass, just the amount of material in forests. I think that just, forests are taking down carbon dioxide, and so are wetlands and any soils. And now, coastal wetlands do not emit methane, so we should keep that in mind when we're thinking of where to restore, because we really need those coastal wetlands for the storms. But other wetlands do emit methane in varying amounts, and they seem to have an overall cooling effect at the scale of centuries. But at any rate, you know, they do probably stabilize things. So there's this idea that all these wetlands around the poles helped keep things warmer there, as well as maybe hurricanes getting further north and just carrying some of that heat from the tropics.
Well, speaking of liquid water, another change, a big change that we've noticed is in precipitation. Some rainstorms have become record floods and snowstorms are doozies. Why is that happening?
Great question. Well, that just goes back to, in some of it, the idea that warmer air holds more moisture. And that's just something to really remember. So it's a two-sided sword, because like here in the desert of Tucson where I live, we get higher evaporation rates when the temperature goes up. So, you know, that it's pulling some of its moisture out of our ground and our plants. But we also get half our rainfall in the 3 months of summer because we are in a monsoon system. And I think a lot of places that, you know, outside of like California, which has a really cold current running next to it, a lot of places do. You're familiar with the extreme summer thunderstorms with lightning. And that's just basic physics again that you see at a lot of scales. And the east, the eastern half of the U.S., there's been a measurable increase in intense storms, and this year's would fit nicely into that trend with all the snow and rain and Rhode Island flooding. And so that would fit in well with that concept. And in general, people looking at the globe as a whole find that when the temperature's higher, you do get more precipitation. And that is actually one of the arguments against the idea of putting more pollution in the air to act like volcanoes and block some of the sunlight, is you would actually be decreasing precipitation overall. And so, you know, what's worse, higher temperatures or less rainfall? You know, I think rainfall is actually, water is so essential to life that that may be really the key here.
And again, in your book, Melanie, you don't shy away from telling us about the uncertainties. I was surprised, for example, to learn that we don't yet have complete measuring tools to know if gross global precipitation has increased or not. I thought all those rain gauges and years of reporting would tell us that for sure. What is missing?
Well, you know, I think that I hope I'm not overstating it, because we can tell it to some degree, but it's just that issue of coverage. I mean, look, here in Tucson, a city of almost 1 million people, we have one official weather station, and now we're trying to supplement that with an unofficial system where people take note of their rainfall. But that's the kind of thing that the world is dealing with, where you've got maybe one station per city or that kind of distance, and meanwhile, rainfall can fall on one side of the street and not the other. So in here, we get a lot of variability during some of our monsoon storms in particular. We might get, you know, an inch of rain in one place and a quarter of an inch in another. So that's just the kind of thing that makes it hard to tell, because temperature is challenging enough, but it's doable, because everywhere, any point that you're going to try to measure, you're going to find a temperature. And, you know, you can estimate those. It's harder to get the actual temperature as the difference from usual. That's why people like to talk about anomalies. But, you know, you can still get a temperature anywhere you go, anytime you want, whereas rainfall is, in our situation, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there for many, many days, and then finally you might get, it's there for an hour. So it's just much spottier, and it's a nonlinear system, unlike temperature, so it's either there or it's not. And then when it is there, you want to know how intense is it, and that just adds another element as well.
We often picture ourselves in an almost human world all by itself, as though these other systems don't exist. And I seldom agree with physicist Freeman Dyson. He has downgraded the importance of climate change from time to time. But Dyson does say our greenhouse gas emissions have triggered a revolution in the plant world. I'm wondering if it's possible that plants, not humans, will control the big climate changes and eventually stabilize the world.
Well, I think if we move out of the way and let them do what they need to do and stop cutting down the forests, I mean, that's a big thing. I mean, how are they supposed to, like, look at the Amazon. The Amazon's been a wonderfully stable system, seems to be generally stable, even through the ice ages and through the hothouse periods. And yet, if we start cutting down as we have been and growing soybeans and beef there instead of forests, how are the plants going to respond? But, you know, on the positive side of that, then if we are going to build these major cities, which, by the way, and I think a lot of people understand this intuitively, are much warmer than the surrounding environment in general because of all the pavement and asphalt, things like that, why don't we bring more forests into the cities? And even in a desert city, we've got so much pavement that all that water is not being soaked up on a rooftop, for instance, or on the street, so we can shunt that water over and effectively increase our water, our precipitation, in effect, you know, enough to support more trees. So I think that we need to think about moving the natural environment into us, since we are taking so much of the environment over, and really put some thought into how our behavior is not only emitting all these greenhouse gases, but also infringing on the systems that would try to help us out of it.
Well, you know, I've heard so many times that the drying world will convert great forests like the Amazon to grasslands, yet you suggest trees and certainly shrubs will come out the winners in climate change. Why do you say that?
Well, the only thing the stuff I've seen on the Amazon is generally based on models, and while I have a lot of respect for the global climate models that can give us the approximate temperature changes, And in fact, a lot of the research that from the past climates that I include in there really points to the same numbers, roughly 5 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature, you know, kind of in the middle of 3 to 8 from a doubling of carbon dioxide levels. So, you know, the model, those models are generally good. But then people take the models. Precipitation's a lot harder to get at. And when you start trying to predict what forests and the plants are going to do, you're adding in all these extra variables. And in fact, people aren't really testing their models on reality at this stage of the game when it comes to that. So a model that takes one of the models that I mentioned in the book took the forest's ability to actually conserve water under conditions of higher carbon dioxide, because basically the same place the plant takes in carbon dioxide would be where it releases water. So if it doesn't have to take in carbon dioxide as often, it can conserve some of its water, which is a, you know, would seem to be the kind of thing that would allow a plant to be more resilient during a warmer climate. And in fact, it does seem to be have been the case. Well, the model now takes that and projects that as a result, rainfall will decline, so the forest will turn into grasslands. Well, that just doesn't seem based in reality to me. And so, you know, I just look at what, I mean, as far as I've seen during these hothouse climates, definitely it'd be great to get some expeditions going instead of science putting all its money into modeling, continuing to support people who want to go out there and collect information about past climates and what even what some of these gases and systems are doing now. We could use definitely more funding for that. But the evidence that we do have does not suggest that the plants are shriveling up and dying during warm climates. And I think that if we have this idea in our mind that they are, and it's a false idea, then we are not taking the opportunity to work with the plants like we could be. You know, if we think, oh, they're all going to die, then why plant more?
Oh, that's such a good point. We talk of a hotter planet. Many of us picture great deserts. And yet I learned from your book, two previous hothouse worlds were highly vegetated with fewer deserts and dry areas. How do we know that?
That one's a little bit harder. It's harder to say because we just basically, the scientists who go out and, you know, collect that data, they have not found any signs of desert per se, except maybe in South China. And I think that refers to the Eocene. But the Eocene and the Cretaceous, which are the two hothouse periods I focus on, are pretty similar vegetation-wise. So that's just it. You know, usually if you can date, like, say, soil nodules or, you know, you can date anything with carbon only goes back about 40,000 years. But there's other means of dating things based on other methods of decay like uranium or thorium. So they can date it with things like that, or now that things have been dated, they can see what kind of fossils are around and they'll know what age they're working in. And then just basically the deserts would show up in the fossil record as kind of evaporites. Like we get that kind of thing here in Tucson where we call it caliche, where after the rain falls into the ground, so it's pulled back so quickly that some of the carbonate that came when carbon dioxide is pulled down through rain, it turns into carbonate or carbonic acid. And so when some of those will come into the soil and then join with the calcium in our soil and turn into calcium carbonate. So you're trying to do a garden and there you have 2 feet underneath the ground. It's like concrete. So that kind of thing, you can find signs of deserts that, you know, that kind of concrete will last a long time and potentially will show up 100 million years later. I do want to just add, if I might, that I wouldn't, you know, I look at the extremes to show basically here's what the Earth does, let's work with it. But I would like to say that this transition period that we're in, I mean, I'm certainly not saying that it's going to be a stable and easy thing. I mean, it's harder to look at in these long time frames what happens in a short period. You know, 100 years, when you're looking at millions of years at a time, gets lost. So I think that we might have some serious concerns ahead. Certainly shifting agriculture is a major problem that I see in coming decades, you know, just trying to figure out what should we be planting where as the climate is shifting around us. So it's not to say that we're going to have an easy time, but it just the idea is that let's at least keep our, let's try to promote what the earth would do and try to keep our forests and our wetlands around.
Well, yeah, you've talked about several other mechanisms that we're really not going to have time to cover today. You talked about the role of soil and wetlands, as you say. Are there other mechanisms that you would list off that people will have to look into that may help balance the climate out?
Well, you know, if you don't mind, I think I'd like to go, because we didn't talk too much about wetlands. I tend to get stuck on forests a lot because that's been my major area of study. But the wetlands are really interesting because not only are they pulling carbon down into their soil, but I don't know if everybody realizes that's where our coal comes from. So the coal that is kind of the root of our problem here in putting the greenhouse gases back up in the air was originally formed by plants in wetlands. So, you know, they did it before, they can do it again. Obviously, that coal is just clearly, you know, like a material version of what some of the carbon dioxide that was in the atmosphere. And they also have this wonderful ability to be like a carbon filter and filter the water and clean it out. And, you know, that is something that gets even more essential as the temperatures warm up, because many of you may be familiar that dead zones in the ocean kind of come from warming temperatures and the oxygen releasing, and also, well, nitrogen fertilizer will come in and bring a bunch of algae in, and then they'll use up all the oxygen as they decay. But if we could get some of that nitrogen fertilizer collected in the wetlands, which they are great collectors of that, we wouldn't be having as many dead zones, which can create problems for, you know, a lot of species, including us. I mean, this is, the sea is one of our more productive sources of food. And I noticed you had David Orr on the show recently, and he's got a lovely system putting that idea of the wetlands to work it right in Overland College, where they're just cleaning the water out there. So it's a proven system.
It's obvious you see wetland protection as a valuable tool to help protect the climate. I'm wondering, could conservation be as important as converting away from fossil fuels?
I think they really need to go hand in hand. I do see them as kind of an equal footing up there. And, you know, both of them need to happen. And in fact, conservation may be a little bit of an easier sell. And so if we can get that started while we haggle over how much CO2 we're going to reduce, or, you know, what we're going to be doing, I mean, that's at least a good start. That can have some major effects right in cities. So cities where you've got your, definitely can expect more heat waves as part of the global warming. And so, you know, why not follow Chicago's example? And after the 1995 heat wave that killed like 700 people, and then they went and decided to start planting more trees and making green roofs, and that's a perfect place for it. And, you know, they're just really focusing on areas where there's not as much vegetation to try to protect them, because during a heat wave, I mean, I grew up in Chicago, and I was in Cleveland during 2003 when the East Coast blackout occurred. That was an August blackout, and it was right at the same time that in England and France, there was a huge heat wave that killed tens of thousands of people. The last number I saw was about 50-some thousand. And in Cleveland and New York and a lot of the East, the power was out for like a day and a half during that same time frame, but luckily it was kind of cool in that part of the country, and we didn't have a major heat wave. But you will lose your air conditioning, your power sometimes during heat waves from all those air conditioners going. So you can be doing these things that are complementary. It's like it's any plant you've got on the ground is helping to pull out carbon dioxide out of the air and keep things cool. It's helping to shade the ground, and it's helping to do the evaporative cooling the same way our sweat does and the earth's precipitation does. Plants are evaporating water from their leaves and helping to keep the environment cool.
So, Melanie, we are out of time, but is there something really important that I've missed or that you'd like to add, maybe a parting message?
I think it's helpful to just remember that nature is powerful, but it can't do it all. I mean, I quote a Diné resident of the Navajo Nation in the book saying, you know, the problem is the solution. It is us. I mean, in this world that we're in now, we've got control over so much of the land that I think we really need to be the stewards and say, hey, we want to encourage the plants. So nature's powerful, and so are we, and let's work together.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Melanie Lenart, a scientist from the University of Arizona and author of the intriguing new book, Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. To find Melanie's webpage, just Google Lenart, and that's spelled L-E-N-A-R-T, and the word Arizona. You can download this interview as a free MP3 from our Climate 2010 page at ecoshock.org. Melanie, I certainly appreciate spending this time with you.
Oh, Alex, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for your wonderful questions, very sophisticated and enlightening questions.
Oh, I love a good compliment. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
We continue to add more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, despite obvious signs of a coming climate shift toward a greenhouse world. It's true Earth has experienced this many times before. In fact, scientific study tells us a hotter, ice-free climate is more normal than the few times of frozen poles and glaciers. Never mind that mammals such as ourselves and our entire civilization survive best in a cooler state, or evidence that rapid climatic shifts lead to mass extinctions. So what will the greenhouse world, the likely future, what would it be like? One model comes from the times of the dinosaurs, the Cretaceous Age, running roughly 144 million to 65 million years ago. We can peer into that distant time with the aid of a spectacular teaching aid developed by the Open University in Britain. It's a textbook for undergraduate studies called The Cretaceous World. It was published jointly by Open University and the Cambridge University Press. The first edition came out in 2002, but it was updated with new science in 2006. As a radio reviewer, I am lucky enough to get many new books for free. But despite my limited budget, I plunked down $65 for this lavishly illustrated textbook. It's been worth every penny. I came upon clear illustrations of how our carbon system works and how the present world developed. Is the Cretaceous a model of the future greenhouse world we are creating by burning fossil fuels while we damage carbon reservoirs in the soil, forests, and the oceans? Yes and no. First of all, the lands of the dinosaurs were very different from the present. For one thing, there was a lot less of it. We learn the Cretaceous oceans covered between 10% and 45% of the present land surface. The fact that there is such a wide range in this guesstimate of how much the oceans overran the land requires an entire chapter of the book. Can't scientists just dig or drill down through the rock layers like an ice core and determine how high the ancient sea level was? Many problems arise and sink because the continents themselves are not fixed the way we experience them, but float on a liquid core of the Earth. They move around greatly over long periods of time, as they did during the Cretaceous, starting out almost as one great land mass called Pangaea, separating into two, and then falling into many segments. Some land rises while other parts of the seafloor fall back into the magma, melting away. Scientists think sea level was at least 200 feet higher than at present during the Cretaceous. It was a hot sea, often 85 degrees Fahrenheit or more. There was much more rain in those times, especially at high latitudes. We do know the land of the dinosaurs was flatter, with fewer big mountain chains. Mountains like the Rockies and the Himalayas are relative newcomers, the latter arising as the floating continent of India slowly crashed into Asia. And there were major changes in plant types. The flowering plants began their near domination of the world during the Cretaceous. Still, we know the Earth during the Cretaceous was at least 10 degrees Celsius warmer than today. There was no ice at either pole. Scientists are still debating whether it was a totally ice-free world. Temperatures were so hot that the regions around the equator often dried out into scrub and deserts, while most of the plant mass grew in the higher latitudes. Instead of a barren tundra in northern Alaska, even at 85 degrees latitude north, there were wet polar forests. We have found intact fossilized tree stumps in the high Arctic, preserved since Cretaceous times. Crocodile bones were found at Canada's Arctic Ellesmere Island. As you have heard, there were major differences in the way the continents, the seas, and the plants were organized in the Cretaceous period. But scientists have found that the basic ways that carbon cycles between the air, the soil, the oceans, and the atmosphere have remained the same. As James Lovelock has warned us, if we reproduce an atmosphere with higher greenhouse gases, we can expect a world unsuitable for most current living species, including ourselves, except for pockets of new life around the Arctic Circle. Given our unprecedented interference in the atmosphere, I join Lovelock in expecting a great migration northwards within one or two generations. For many species of plants and animals, that journey has already begun. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.